and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Blah, 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 blah.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to you lurking conservatives who choose to email me through my website. Very nice. Always nice to hear from the haters. Always good. Good and healthy. Also to hear from the lovers. Always good to hear from them, too, and to hear how much you know, we need to do and what we should be doing and how we're doing a good job. But, yeah, there's always the but, Mark Riley. But.
But.
How do you handle kids? How do you handle them? I don't have any, but I'll tell you something, man. I was walking down the street. This was just the other day. I was walking down the street, and there was a, you know, one of those sick pigeons. You know those pigeons that's just sitting there because it can't do anything?
They got legionnaires.
Well, yeah, whatever the hell they have, there's two kids, I don't know, unsupervised kids sitting there going, just sitting there poking it. And I'm like, don't touch it. It's sick.
and that's for their mom to deal
but
with.
Right, but the little girl's like, it is? Like, I was supposed to finish a conversation. Yes, isn't it sad that it's sick? I think we should take it to the hospital. You know, I just kept walking, and I would turn back, and they'd moved on. But, you know, come on. Tell your kids not to touch dead birds or dying birds. And then I go to the Rite Aid, and then there's that kid. There's the cart with the mom who's got the kid who's got the sweaty red face. And he's just like, hachis! You know, just like goo flying everywhere. And I'm like, can't you leave the kid home or something? What do you got to bring the viral dispenser into the supermarket for? I understand it's hard that there's not...
They have no choice.
Well, I get it, but shouldn't there be a like some sort of quarantine pen in major supermarkets? Some sort of like where you just put all the snotty little sick kids? Am I wrong?
They need one of those buffet barriers over stuff.
Yeah, something. Or just, you know, at least teach your kid to cover its mouth. I mean, maybe I'm being selfish. I don't know. But, you know, I just see, and Pashman was telling me the story about how he was at Target the other day. And some, get him in here. I want to hear that Target story where he had a kid. Now, I got nothing against kids. I love kids. So you went to Target yesterday, and what the hell happened?
Oh, man, the whole Target trip was a real debacle yesterday. It was rough.
What were you going there to buy?
I needed window shades. I needed some shaving cream. I was going to get air filters.
You got see, that's the thing that you can do now when you shop. It's like, yeah, I need some gum and tires.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
It was never like that before.
But you know what I found out about that whole concept? Because, you know, in the past when I've been at Target, it was like right when I was moving into an apartment.
Mm.
So I just needed everything.
Yeah.
So I just sort of walked all the aisles and picked out what I needed. Like, you never know how much stuff you need until you go to a place like Target. You're like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
When you go with a list of, like, five things, it takes forever.
Come on.
You can't
why?
Find anything. When you're looking for a few specific items, you will wander for hours and you can't find a damn thing.
It's like walking across the street in Las Vegas. I don't know if you know that feeling, but when you're in Vegas for some reason, if you're like at Caesars or something, I don't even know why. This is the only time I can remember this because I don't go to Vegas.
Right.
I haven't been there in 10 years. But if you just sort of, just go across to the MGM and literally it'll take you half a day.
Right.
It looks like it's right over there. But like when you're in Target, it's like, just go back there. It's in the audio section 3 days later.
Right.
You're like, am I here yet?
Is there a people mover in this thing?
Yes. Well, so what happened with the kid though? You're talking about
so I'm walking around and all of a sudden I hear this kid I hear like a coughing that quickly turns into a gagging, which I won't replicate on the air because it's pretty nauseating.
Yeah, people are having coffee and donuts.
And then I look over and there's this mother walking with a couple kids around, and one of whom is gagging, and she starts talking to the kid really loudly. So that everyone around this end of the store can hear. She's like, "Are you gonna throw up? Are you gonna throw up again? Because you know, if you're gonna throw up, we gotta go find a trash can. Let me know now if you're about to vomit. We'll go find a trash can.
Wait,
be okay?
Vomit on something that people will be touching throughout the day. Vomit on something that on the shelf, please, and so they can come wipe it off and smear your little flu germs all over everything.
Exactly. It was disgusting. And, I mean, she could at least have been a little discreet about it. But you watch the funny thing is the reaction of all the other shoppers is she is screaming this throughout the store.
Disgusting. I think it's brilliant. I think she was a shoplifter. She just wanted to get everybody out of the way, create the distraction. And the next thing you know, she's piling stuff into her car.
I don't know.
So she's obviously to you a thief.
Absolutely.
It's all big plan.
It's all planned ahead of time.
She probably runs a home for retarded children.
Right? Well, I don't know about
that. What neighborhood do you live in?
The kid throws up. She's like, great, my plan goes into action. Finally, the kid's sick again. We can go get some stuff, some clothing for him.
Hey, the kid's healthy as a horse. Believe me. It's the same thing as somebody bumping into you and then the other guy goes in your pocket.
Right, the mom's in there, drink the Ipecac.
Yeah.
We need 3 boxes of cereal.
Yeah.
Put this in the baby
bag. Need some Similac for the little one.
Right. Yeah, bring the gay kids so we can get some condoms.
I think I'm getting
it.
Wait, where did this just go? What happened? I reached over to get my tea.
And here comes Pashman.
Oh, did we cross the Pashman line? We did. I guess I'm getting resentful, though, because I don't have kids. I don't think my wife wants to have kids right now. And maybe that's what it is. Because I think I like kids for a few days anyway. But, boy, I get
They're
spiteful.
Wonderful, trust me.
They are. Yeah?
Yeah. I love kids.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, but see, you've got one kid now, and you've got an older kid.
I've got older kids, yeah.
So you don't have this issue. There was a story in the paper today that we'll get to in a second, but I want to talk to Chris because he said something that was sort of provocative before the show. So he's thinking,
I did?
Yeah, you said you were thinking about doing it.
Yeah, man, I'm thinking about proposing to my girlfriend.
This is unbelievable. This is big news.
Yeah, it is big news.
So I remember when I proposed to my first wife. Clearly, you live and learn. But
how did you do it, actually?
How did I do it? It was kind of sad because I've been with her a long time, and I was with her like 8 years. So that takes a little momentum out of the proposal. when you've been with somebody that long, you sort of like saying, "You want to break up or this?" You know? Yeah. But what happened was I was on the road. I was actually with Mitch Hedberg, who is dead now. God rest his soul. There. I was on the road with Hedberg. And we're in Arizona, which is where my wife grew up, so she had a connection with a jeweler there. Her family did. Like, I knew it was going to be tipped, but I figured I might as well go to the guy that's a friend of the family so I can get a good deal on the rock, right?
Sure.
So I just wake up, I tell Hedberg, I'm like, I'm going to go get a ring. This is it. This is the day. I went and got a ring, and then she flew in a couple of days later, and I gave her, this is how romantic I am, I gave it to her in the car at the airport.
Yeah.
Did you get down on one knee under the steering wheel?
No.
I kind of said, I could do this the other way, but you're here, and I'm kind of excited. Anyway you do it, it's still going to be a little...
That marriage is doomed from the beginning,
It's
huh?
a tear bomb, though. You you got the box, it's going to have the same effect no matter where you are.
Right.
You could be anywhere. You just give them the box, and it's like crying. And then you have that weird moment of like, oh, what did I just do? What?
Because he's going to have that moment. Chris Lopresto will have that moment.
Well, now, Riley, did that happen to you when you gave your wife the ring? Like, how'd that happen?
It was pretty routine, actually. She had been bugging me for a while. Oh, okay, fine. Here, catch.
Catch and cry.
Yeah, there you
catch
go.
And...
Nah, I mean, it was cool. The crying part, I guess, was actually saved for the day of the wedding. They get caught up in the emotion of the moment. And,
yeah, I tell you. I mean, don't do it because I don't mean, do it. No.
Not that way.
You got to not have any secrets if you can help it. You got to really know that you want to do it. You can't be sitting there going, maybe it's the right thing to do. Why not? It's been a long time, or what the hell,
do you know it's the right thing to do, though?
But when with the wife that with Mishna, I knew when I met her that I was one person off. Do you understand that I was with somebody else? I was with somebody that I knew from the beginning. I didn't really believe in the type of love that, people say you can have when you get married. You just know. Because I was so jaded and screwed up in the head, I didn't believe that that kind of love existed. So I'd been with this woman a long time, and we were comfortable, we were friends, I loved her, and I just thought, well, I guess this is what you do now.
Right.
Because I didn't assume that I could have that experience of wait, I have no choice, you're the person, And when I met the Mishna, I had that, and I still have that. And the thing is, if you don't have that at the core of your relationship, I believe that you're doomed because you have nothing to fall back on. If everything starts to fall apart, if you get into a fight, if you get into unsurmountable difficulties, and you don't at least have that kind of love in your memory of how you felt, oh my God, if that isn't there in place in your memory, what are you going to fall back on? You're going to be like, oh man, I'm looking for reasons here.
No, you're right, and I think I do have that. But the problem is, I think I've had that with two or three other people.
But how long were you with them, really?
2 and 3 years.
Oh, I had that with a person for a week.
Do you believe there's only one right person for each person?
Oh no. No, that's
neither do I.
Two or three, at least.
That's crazy.
For some especially agreeable people, there's thousands.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then for those
you have low expectations,
right.
Yeah.
If you're, or if you're really laid back, if you're like, eh, whatever.
Yeah, but then for those who don't make the cut, there's a hot plate in a room with a bathroom down the hall.
Yeah, yeah.
And they stay there all day for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
Are you talking about like bachelor towers?
Yeah. No, I'm talking about old man towers.
Oh,
you know, when folks get to the point where there is no chance that they're going to meet anybody.
Yeah. See, I don't want to get to that point.
Yeah. Well, I think you're just a week away from that. I don't think you need to be. You know,
it
you don't want to be. You don't want to be at the Riley Hot Plate SRO.
Hey. Hey. And Hot Plate's got a very unique smell, I can tell you.
They still have those?
Of course they do.
And then what do you do with that? You just get the canned food.
You get the canned food. You go down to the store. You come back with a bag full of cans. You heat up. You make string bean salad sandwiches. You make all kinds of stuff.
Riley's full of information. He had no idea he knew.
Yeah,
Hot Plate lessons with Mark. Right. Hilarious cooking show.
I spent time at the Terminal Bar. Anybody that's ever spent time at a low-life bar in New York City knows how people live.
Isn't that once called the hardest bar in New York? It's right across from Grand
from
Port Authority.
Authority. Yeah, I think it's now a falafel stand or something. I don't know. But yeah,
but it's
the Terminal
ghosts.
Bar. Yeah, it does have some
watch
ghosts.
Watch those falafel balls. There's the ghost of dead junkies in the falafel bar.
Yeah. There's like four or five places there in that same area. There was another place called the Wakamba Cocktail Lounge, which is still there, by the way.
Yeah,
really?
That's the place that when I was talking about my New York City's Best Dive Bars book, Riley was like, we're going to put your book to the test. If the Wakamba's in there, then your book is legit.
It was in there.
Yeah.
How long do you stay at a dive bar, though? I mean, I understand that there's a sort of a kind of, you know, retro, kind of romantic sleaze to it, but do you really hang out there?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, the places I went to had no romance.
Yeah.
Trust me. I mean, these are guys.
Desperation.
No, man. I mean, look, these were guys. Yeah. When I used to hang out in these places, they were very different because they catered to the people that worked in Penn Station, that worked in the post office.
Sure.
And these were some hard guys. Some
of them. Guys just trying to get a little hope.
Yeah,
get
a little dope.
Which, you know, fills the same hole.
Absolutely.
If you live through one, you get the other.
Hey, we better take a break.
Yeah, we'll be back. We're going to talk about kids in a minute. Apparently, we've got a good show, actually. Let me say that first. We've got former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Army Reservist Aiden Delgado, who witnessed some really horrific abuses at the hands of American soldiers. Michael Eric Dyson later in the show to talk about how Bill Cosby is wrong. And also, when we come back, there's a story out that says that parents will favor their more attractive children, much to the sadness of the ugly ones. 18 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
978-800-603-9978-800-603-9978.
Hey, it's 23 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. So, Kalo, you going to ask her or what? Have you decided?
Well,
I'm thinking
about it. Like, all right. I'm thinking about it because I have to save up for the ring.
Yeah, you're going
to
have to.
You know, and I don't know how long I have to save up for the ring. Maybe like 5 months, maybe a year.
Yeah, you got to get him a nice ring. They say they don't care, but...
Oh, yeah, right.
Well, but the problem is...
Try getting engaged with a poem. Since we're really in love, I just thought I'd write you a poem of engagement.
But, yeah, right. I'm marrying you.
Yeah.
But my girlfriend loses all the rings that I get. Right?
Oh, dude,
lose that.
No, but she does not lose like her $5 ring she gets at the mall.
Right.
But she loses like the Tiffany ring that I bought her.
Oh man, I have to deal with that. I have to deal with a wife that does that. You're just gonna have to. You're going to have to buy her one that you can, you know, just
afford
realize
to lose.
Might go away.
Well, can I get insurance on such a thing?
Sure you can.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds exciting.
Yeah, you can tell that to her when you give it to her. It's like, hey, you can lose this because, you know, I realize that you're completely irresponsible and I insured it.
That's a good way to start.
Yeah, it's really nice. So, look, this story kind of jumped out at me because these Canadian researchers have done a story. They looked at parents in supermarkets, and we were just talking about that. We were sort of going this direction. We didn't go this direction. And apparently, more so than not, these parents, if there's, you know, the kids need to be buckled into something or they need to be taken care of or watched, that they will always sort of favor the more attractive kid, the cute kid. It's the ugly kid that ends up wandering the aisles alone. It's the ugly kid that's not strapped in properly. And there's proof of this, Riley. And
I know. This is scary, actually.
Well, you only have one daughter now, so you don't have to make these decisions. I grew up with two kids, but I was favored because, look at me, I'm loud, I'm needy. I was the first child of my parents and my grandparents, so I don't know if I'm necessarily more attractive than my brother. I think some people would say so, but
you're probably the most attractive.
I don't know. He's tall, he's blonde. You know, I don't know how the hell it happened. Clearly, you know, I pummeled him into thinking he was less attractive, and that has sort of stuck. But
I hate older brothers.
You do?
You're ugly.
Yeah. Well, you know, something like that. But eventually we made up. It's still kind of dicey between us, but he's doing okay. But this is a real thing. I wish we had some more parents in here to sort of validate this. But I think this is one of those secrets that parents wouldn't want to admit. But, you know, if you watch movies like Ordinary Children, it has to happen. Parents are only human. You're going to like one of them better, aren't you?
I don't know. I always was seen as the favored one out of me and my younger brother and younger sister. They always used to say, "Oh, mommy always, you know, she treats you better." Why? I do not know.
Yeah, ordinary people. I brought it up because remember the one kid, the jockey kid, the kid that the Mary Tyler Moore character loved
more than the other one,
died tragically, and Timothy Hutton had to deal with this mom who he realizes ultimately just doesn't like him.
Doesn't like him. Yeah. And that's not the first. I mean, I've seen that actually happen in real life with people and their kids, where it is clear where there are multiple number of same sex children that the mother or the father favors the one child.
I wonder if those kids do better. I wonder which kid does better. I guess that's another part of the study. My mom once told me that she really didn't know how to love me when I was a kid. But she was really young when she had me, and she was like, she said to me, she said, "I'm sorry, I just had no idea how to. I'm not sure I liked you initially." I'm like, "Well, you know what? That was one of the things you could have kept secret, I think."
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Could
have kept that one to yourself.
I needed to know that one. Well, you know, your parents, if you are like my mom with the weight thing, and some parents, if you're a reflection on them, so if you represent something they don't want to see in themselves, I imagine it takes a tremendous amount of emotional maturity to transcend those feelings and behave properly in a more selfless fashion with your kids.
Well, yeah, but you got to learn to detach yourself from your kids in terms of, I mean, it's like having a pet or something. You can't. I don't think you can put that on children. I don't think it's fair.
Who wants to have an ugly pet?
Just put the kid in the backyard and let him fend for himself.
Yeah.
Look, we're going to come back. We're going to talk to Madeline Albright about Iran and Iraq and some other stuff that she's got going on. So stay with us. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Where they've been and where they're going on the next Kyle Jason Show this Saturday night on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Joining us by phone from Washington, D.C. is the former Secretary of State. She is also the head of the National Democratic Institute, and today marks the 10-year anniversary of the NDI's Win with Women initiative. At an event later today, the Women's Political Caucus of Indonesia will receive the first annual Madeline K. Albright grant for their efforts to advance women's political leadership. Good morning, Madam Secretary Madeline Albright. How are you this morning?
I'm very good. Thanks a lot.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Before we get into the Win with Women initiative event later, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about the new Iraqi government and the increase in attacks by the insurgency, and whether or not you think that the government that's in place and the possibility of filling some cabinet positions with Sunnis will stop some of this horrendous insurgency fighting.
Well, that's the hope, and I think everybody is very troubled by the fact that the government has not been able to fill all the posts, because part of the issue here has been is how to make sure that the Sunnis, who are part of a very complex structure in Iraq, are not really represented. And in order to have Iraq work, all the different factions have to be represented. And the hope is that once they are, the insurgencies will stop, but we, I think, continue to be in a rather confused situation in Iraq.
Now, it seems that a lot of the casualties are in Iraqi military, and it seems that the American military is moving more towards an advisory position with some of these troops, and there's talk about pulling the troops out of Iraq as soon as possible. Do you feel that this is a good move?
Well, I have said the following thing about Iraq, is that it was a war of choice, not of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
But getting things right is a necessity and not a choice. And it is very hard for the people of Iraq to rebuild their lives, both literally in terms of reconstruction and figuratively in terms of them feeling that they can go on. And Americans have been the ones to provide the security, and we are waiting to make sure that the Iraqis are trained enough to deal with the security issues. So I hope very much that the Americans can come out, because we are hearing all kinds of reports that our own military is now undermanned, very hard to get recruits, and that it creates problems in terms of our responsibilities in other places.
Madam Secretary, the United Nations is the venue for discussions about nuclear nonproliferation, and Iran is playing a central role along with North Korea. And I wanted to ask you, first of all, whether you, because the Iranians have now said they're going to resume their attempts to acquire nuclear technology, do you think this government can trust that Iran will not use that technology for weapons development?
Well, this is the major loophole in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They are actually allowed to develop peaceful uses, and the hope was that during this renegotiation of the NPT, there would be a way to close that loophole. I think it's a very tough position, because what has to happen if they do go back to peaceful uses, they need to allow the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, to go back in and do the inspections. It can't be based on trust. It has to be based on, as Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify. So the question is, can they go forward in a way that the other members of the community feel that they are not cheating? But this is a very serious aspect of a loophole in the NPT.
But now there are some people who side with the Iranians on this that say that the Western powers that are seeking to deny them this technology haven't fulfilled their own obligations under the same treaty.
Well, that is true. The NPT is based on a grand bargain that the major powers that have nuclear weapons would systematically disarm. And as we know, that has not taken place. And the United States, in fact, is thinking about a new generation of nuclear weapons. So the grand bargain that the haves would not increase and the have-nots would not acquire has basically not been fulfilled.
So, Madam Secretary, you've met Kim Jong-il, and I imagine not a nice fellow, is he?
No, he's not. I mean, I have the dubious honor of, it's interesting. In person, he's perfectly polite. You know that his country, that he's starving people and that he's a dictator. There's no question about that.
And with these new threats and this harsh talk, I mean, how are we supposed to handle him? I mean, how's America supposed to deal with this?
Well, the main thing is that it's been totally mishandled in the last 4 years, because whether you like the guy or not, arms control agreements are made with your enemies, not your friends, and I think we lost a chance to be able to get him to give up his missile technology and to keep a nuclear program frozen. So you can't deliver tough messages if you are not in contact, and I think that we need to have bilateral talks with him within the context of these six-party talks, but it doesn't do any good to say we're never going to talk to you, because how are we going to tell him that he can't have his nuclear weapons if we are not in direct contact?
I like that you qualified that with whether you like the guy or not, because I'm pretty sure there's not a lot of people out there going, hey, come on, lay off Kim Jong-un.
Right. I mean, nobody has a brief for him. He is doing dreadful things.
Exactly. So let's talk about Win with Women initiative event later today. You tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, National Democratic Institute really wanted to help women throughout the world be able to participate in political activities. The whole purpose of NDI is to really help create political parties and have political activities, and it has to happen for women. So we have created this global action plan. We've had women leaders from 27 countries come together to talk about how to enhance political opportunities for women. And so the plan is to remove restrictions on women's political participation, increase the number of women elected officials at both the national and local levels, make sure that political parties include women in meaningful positions, not just kind of auxiliary women's parties, but have them be part of the mainstream, and encourage greater participation of women in government decision making. So it's an action plan to get women a rightful place in political power. And today we are in fact honoring a group of women from Indonesia who have created a multi-party organization that has women from political parties and civic organizations and governments and trade unions, the academia and media, so that they can really help in advocating for laws to increase women's representation.
So has this been has this program been a success in the broadest sense in other countries as well?
Absolutely, and it is throughout in the developing world, and also obviously in some of the developed countries, because not everybody has equal rights for women. So I think it's a very big and important thing. It has also been a part of organizational discussions at the OAS or within various larger international groupings. So it's throughout the world. I'm very proud of it. And having the opportunity to honor people today specifically is a great way to move forward.
Madam Secretary, I want to take advantage of your expertise as someone who spent some time inside the Beltway, obviously. We're seeing now questions being raised about many of the trips that members of Congress make overseas, specifically whether or not lobbyists are involved in these kinds of trips, helping to fund them, helping to provide access for them. And I'm wondering, in many instances, these trips are made under the umbrella of diplomacy. When you were Secretary of State, did you ever hear about a trip or a series of trips that actually accomplished that on the part of members of Congress?
Well, I do not know about the payment for this, but let me just make the following point. I felt very, very strongly that it was important for members of Congress to travel. I think that the only way to really learn about what is going on in a foreign country is to be there and meet with leaders. And I know that there are always these allegations about junkets or shopping or whatever, but the bottom line is that serious members of Congress actually carry on important discussions and create links with other parliamentarians. I think one of the important parts of how the U.S. comports itself in the world is to have links not just government to, executive to executive, but to have parliamentarians talk to each other, civic groups talk to each other, because it's only through that kind of understanding. So I've always thought that when people just say, oh, well, they're just traveling abroad on a junket, that they misunderstand what the purpose of a lot of really valuable trips is. Now, granted, I honestly do not know about the details of this. I do know that just a blanket saying that the traveling by members of Congress is wrong is a very short-sighted view.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright. I appreciate you being with us, and congratulations with the Win with Women initiative.
Great, and thank you so much for letting me talk about it.
No, thank you, Madam Secretary.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Of course, members of Congress should travel, but there should be a certain amount of transparency, and we should obviously know, who's paying for it and for what reasons they're paying
and
for
what
it.
And what they're actually doing when they're over there. Because, see, in some instances, we've seen reports that they kind of make up the reasons for going after they get back.
Yeah, and after, some of the money's been used for, God knows what, and whose pocket has it gone into, really, and where's it going, and who's profiting from this. I mean, yeah, obviously global diplomacy is important, but when you got a bunch of corrupt bastards like the Congress that we have now, in terms of someone like Tom DeLay, who's been under ethics investigation 3 times, that, you should ask these questions, and ethics should come into it. We didn't have time with her to go into all that, but that was not why we had her to begin with. But it was certainly nice talking to her. It's 45 past the hour. We will be back to talk about PBS and, some of the last stages of conservative takeover in terms of the media after this, Air America Radio.
Hi, this is former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. Remember me? I helped preside over the greatest economic expansion in our nation's history, creating over 20 million new jobs during including years. I'm sorry to hear that the Bush administration has either outsourced or eliminated your job entirely. But while you're waiting for things to turn around, stay tuned to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You'll be back,
our estate variation. Call American Life, 1-866-492-2500. That's 1-866-492-2500.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly.
Hey.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Man, this song makes me want to be 15, driving in my buddy's Firebird down I-40 in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with nothing to do, nowhere to go. Go park outside a liquor store and try to get a grown-up to buy some Southern Comfort and a six-pack of Miller.
Ooh.
Man. Oh, look at this. Oh, there's a woman in the studio.
Uh-oh. Hey, this is historic here.
Huh? I have a little issue with Julia.
Right. Julia is on the staff of the Rachel Maddow Show, and apparently she was listening to our talk about marriage, about getting married, about Chris, Kalo, our board up, wanting to get married, and you don't think he's ready?
Yeah.
Why?
Maybe I shouldn't have said that.
Well, why would you say such a thing?
I didn't mean it in an offensive way. I just, you know, what's the rush? And just because you've been living with her and because...
For about a year.
For about a year.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know. It just doesn't seem right.
But why do you say that I'm not ready to get married?
Like, yeah, he's he wants. He feels.
Right.
Is there something you sense about his being that implies to you that this is not a man that should be getting married?
I feel like I'm shooting myself in the head.
What?
Kalo's
going
to be it only hurts for a minute. Trust me.
How bad is it going to be if Kalo's mad at you?
Yeah.
No, it's not about. I mean, I don't know your relationship personally, and your girlfriend's lovely, and I'm sure you guys get along well. But you know, you just don't seem ready. You're not the kind of you don't go home and rush home to have dinner or breakfast. You know, you like to go out. You like to talk to the
ladies. Work at 4 a.m.
He does. But you know, he.
Well, maybe we should get into your expectations.
Yeah, exactly. how
old are you?
I'm 22.
Okay, you're 22, and clearly the idea of a man running home to dinner. And
you see that on TV or something?
what is that?
Do you live in the five boroughs?
I do.
The weird thing is, I actually do that. I'm the big wuss here. I mean, I will go and cook and do everything I can, bend over backwards for my wife. But that's me. Is
yeah,
that what
I heard your discussion of it earlier, and you know, you're just like you knew that you were going to be with your current wife,
right?
And, you know, Chris is like, well, when am I going to know, you know?
Well, I can't ask questions. Like, this isn't appropriate.
Well, you can ask, but Mark is not going to know.
Wow.
Actually, I do know. I just don't want to break it to him. See, you being a little...
But now, Julie, now
oh,
your boyfriend...
Oh, so done.
Now, Julie, your boyfriend, does he rush home and cook you dinner?
He doesn't rush home, but he cooks dinner.
Okay, so I cook dinner.
Maybe
I don't rush home because she's not home when I get home. There's no rush to get home.
Isn't your boyfriend some sort of weird vegan? Doesn't he have to cook
just
to make sure?
No, he eats a lot of meat.
Who's the vegan? What? I thought he was some kind of vegan guy.
No, he's not weird, and he's not a vegan.
Not weird or vegan now.
He's weird.
He's just
not a
one?
Vegan.
I have no idea. That's why I'm not getting married.
How long have you been with him?
Over 2 years.
Over 2 years and still not clear.
Not sure.
What's the rush? I'm 22. What's the rush, Mark?
That just means like you really don't want to marry this guy.
No, I don't want to get married right now. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, there isn't.
No.
There's nothing to be ashamed of.
No, I know. So don't make me feel bad.
You may have just broke your boyfriend's heart.
No,
you know that, right?
He doesn't want to get married either.
So he tells you.
No.
But what?
He doesn't cook you dinner for nothing, pal.
Do you believe there's a one?
You
believe it's just some sort of weird decision?
Like three?
There's some sort of weird decision you make out of the blue.
4.5?
That you're going to be hit with some sort of bolt and go, this is it?
No, I don't believe that.
So
I believe, like, you know, like you were saying earlier, there are people that, you know, there's more than one. There's maybe two. There's maybe six.
Right.
Six?
And some are better than others. And you're just sort
some
of...
Some are better than others, you know.
And
exactly. And, you know, and when you're ready, when you don't want to... You know, Kalo, you like... you like to talk to women.
Switching the subject.
Now
it's getting dicey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, so that's wrong. So you're.
No, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm not. I don't mean to insult you. I just, you know, what's the rush?
But you mean like talk? You mean like talk? Like, you know, hey,
flirt? I think she's trying to say flirt.
Yeah. But I got a question for you now. If there are six, what if you're with number three and meet number five?
You know, that's rough.
That's rough.
I feel like that happens.
Whoa,
all
number
time.
Three and then number five. So you're not only meeting the next one, you're meeting like one or two ahead.
One or two ahead. Yeah, you're with number three. You figure you're settled with number three, and you meet number five, and all of a sudden number five, you know, you react to number five by saying, "Wow, this one could be better than number three."
It sounds to me that somebody ought to be keeping a notebook.
Is it number three or number four?
Well, this is weird because I just realized that I've become I've become sort of flirtatiously challenged. Because, like, you're sitting here, and I know that I'm afraid to flirt. I think I've tried to flirt with you before, and I sort of broke up in the middle. Like, I sort of like
went out into the ether, right?
You know, sort of like I walked in, like, hey, oh, no. I don't know how to do this anymore. And I just sit there going, okay.
Your flirt muscles have atrophied.
They have. Which is a good thing. Thank God my wife's not going to wake up till 2. So she's not going to hear this. But I remember feeble attempts, like, hey, oh, no.
It might just be me, though. I think I have that effect on many men.
You do? You find that a lot when they come up to you?
I find that a lot. I'm kind of, like, serious, and people...
Do you do it on purpose?
No, it's really not on purpose. I think I get anxious, and you're an anxious person.
I'm not anxious.
Okay.
Oh, no. I'm a little anxious. I think this is the longest conversation we've ever had.
It might be.
You're laughing.
No, you know what? You took one look at her. I know, but you took one look at her, and you know what you thought?
What?
Lawsuit.
But that's funny. It's like, I swear, we've worked together for a year, and this is the most animated conversation we've had. I had no idea. She just wants to be on radio. She doesn't like me at all.
No.
And this is what this
is. Oh, is that what this is about? When she likes you?
You have that becoming problem. Chris, I think she's saying you shouldn't get married because, you know, she...
Just because.
She thinks you're too young and that...
And I'm supposed to be a broken man and not flirt with any other people.
And learn how to cook
dinner. A broken man.
That's hilarious.
Oh, my God.
How did I take the hit for being there? I was trying to navigate this round table. And I take the hit. That's what I get, Kayla. A broken man.
Why do you have to take it so personal?
Have you seen my wife?
Yeah.
All right, shut up.
Do you have a picture? I don't know. Do you want me to see you naked? I don't know.
What am I saying?
Yeah.
I'm saying, I'm a broken man. Boy, I should just feel bad every day with my wife. You're right, man. I'm going to go home and cry on my 6-foot-tall, beautiful wife's shoulder.
Probably will, actually.
Yeah, so what? So what? If that's what being broken is,
Bring it on. You don't want to be fixed. What are you going to do?
Exactly. Well, thank you, Julia, for your input.
Thanks for having me.
I don't know how I ended up being getting
hurt. The bad guy?
All right. Why don't you have some noodles?
Oh, my God. Life goes on.
I guess we'll talk about PBS later, right, Riley?
Sure. We're going to come and talk about PBS. We're going to talk to Aiden Delgado.
It's 6 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, any of you listening to 1530 WCKY in Cincinnati, the revolution of talk radio. I will be there this Friday and Saturday at Go Bananas. You can go to morningsedition.com for ticket information. Also, later in the show, we have Michael Eric Dyson in the studio to discuss his new book, Is Bill Cosby Right or Has the Black Middle Class Lost Its Mind? A little later, we'll be talking to Army Reservist Aiden Delgado, who witnessed some pretty nasty abuses by the military in Iraq. He's going to talk to us on the phone. He was featured in Monday in Bob Herbert's New York Times column. But before we get into all that, I just want to, you know, update people on the right's progress to infiltrate almost everything about this culture. Over a 30-year period of time since the Powell Manifesto in the early 70s, since the fall of Barry Goldwater, the religious right and the conservative right have put a concerted effort, a very organized grassroots networking effort, and millions and billions of dollars into infiltrating all elements of society, government, religion, and culture. And now they're gunning for PBS. Now we're in trouble. Now these guys want to turn PBS into some sort of, you know, a pablum mill, some sort of conservative pablum mill. See you later, Frontline. See you later, McNeil Lara. See you later, Ken Burns documentary. See you later, all that, you know, real news that comes out, you know, with the context of truth and journalism. Kenneth Y. Tomlinson, the Republican chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, was once the editor-in-chief of Reader's Digest. One of the great exercises in conservative revisionism has been consistent, you know, propaganda and excisement of any sort of creativity for years. And now he's taken his agenda to PBS. And, I, you know, Riley, why don't you explain to me how the hell this works? So what, are they going to cut it up? Because I know that government money pays for PBS. Newt Gingrich was against government funding for PBS. But they want to make it a propaganda mill. This idea that it's not balanced enough or that it's too liberal is ridiculous. There's a difference between bias and truth. There's a difference between reporting that Tom DeLay has had three ethics committee reprisals against him for specific reasons and, you know, crapping on Tom DeLay.
Well, what we have here is an incremental assault on PBS, an attempted rape of PBS. You're right. Newt Gingrich in the mid-1990s wanted to defund the network. He was not successful in doing so. So now that the Republicans are in power, they're trying a different tack. They're going to try and, I believe, destroy it from within, at least PBS as we now know it. Tomlinson is, first of all, a Republican operative, but also a guy who believes in the bottom line. And I really believe that what they're going to start doing, when you hear about them tracking different PBS shows for evidence, quote, evidence of bias, when you hear about them burying not one but two different polls that indicate the American public don't have a problem with in general, there is no problem as far as the majority of Americans are concerned with PBS's, quote, liberal bias. What you realize is that they will begin to use funding and audience to destroy this network. And they'll do that in incremental steps. You're not going to hear about Ken Burns getting funded so much for some of the things that he does. These people have no interest in having documentaries about Jack Johnson. And that's not even about their news coverage. It's just in terms of their mindset, in terms of the way the conservatives perceive that the people who run PBS look at the world. That's why the last person who was in charge at PBS left so abruptly.
Well, the thing is that unfortunately they're wrong, because what we're trying to do and what people want from PBS, they're getting information. This is the scary thing about the way the world is working right now, the way the United States is working at right now. These people, the conservatives, out of fear that the free market would come out of assault, you know, in the early 70s, have put into place all these think tanks and all these operatives to really stop anybody from questioning the integrity of the free market and questioning the conservative agenda. So now they're infiltrating, you know, PBS. And the problem is that most people, a lot of people, believe that it gives them good information. You know, this is an amazing thing, these polls. Americans were asked whether they believed these things were true. WMDs were discovered in Iraq. Iraq was involved in 9/11. There was wide international support for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Percentage of TV audiences that thought one or more of these misperceptions was true. Fox watchers, 80%. CBS watchers, 71%. ABC watchers, 61%. NBC watchers, 55%. CNN watchers, 55%. Print media, 47%. PBS NPR audience, 23%. And they are right here, because they were able to glean information from these public broadcasting outlets that gave them the real information.
But see, it even goes beyond information. There are people, and by the way, Education Secretary Margaret Spellings is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
They are going way beyond just the news and information component of what PBS does. They are reaching down into children's broadcasting and saying that there is a liberal bias in the children's broadcasting. Somebody, you know, meeting a fictitious cartoon character who meets a couple of lesbians, that's a liberal bias to them. So they want those kinds of things taken out of PBS programming at every single level that the network operates. And remember that some of their highest rated programs are kids programs.
Yeah, this is the horrible truth of conservative propaganda, is that what we believe are our civil rights, what we believe are our freedoms that everybody should enjoy, what we believe is a lifestyle that should be accepted and tolerated. Diversity, tolerance, acceptance are words that some people within the right think are bad. That's bad words. Tolerance is bad. You shouldn't have to tolerate it because it's wrong. And they will say these kind of things in the face of denying Americans their civil rights to, you know, exist in the life that they want to have. Certainly you're seeing that with gay marriage amendments in the Constitution, state constitutions, and the stopping of civil unions in specific states. But this is what they want to do. This is how they train kids. This is how they start to filter and take away, you know, what liberals and Democrats have worked for a long time. Tolerance, acceptance, diversity, reproductive freedom, all the principles that we hold important to us, they are going to stifle through propaganda and now through PBS and now through the minds of kids. And it's awful. And they've been planning this for years. I don't even know apparently thousands of people have written to PBS. Apparently thousands of people are up in arms about this. But I'll tell you something. Unless you have the power of a boycott or the power to really move your state representatives in the direction that you want them to do, these people don't care. This is not going to make an impact. I feel powerless and angry about this kind of thing.
Well, see, what we see happening here is something that is continuing to take place inside the Bush administration, and it's taking place here as well. The polling that was done by a Republican polling firm. This was not a bunch of radicals who decided that this was the attitude and the opinions of the American people. The fact is, this was a GOP polling group called the Terrence Group, and they've worked with the Bush-Cheney 04 campaign, the Republican National Committee, Senators Mike DeWine and Trent Lott. So these are not people who have an interest in hiding any liberal bias that was there. And when they came back with their first set of studies in 2002, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting told them to go back to the well again.
Because they didn't get the numbers they want. That sounds familiar. They didn't. Yeah, they found that too many people were getting good information from PBS, and the type of people that watched it were looking for journalistic integrity, which it had, and that pissed them off.
Yeah, and they don't have, at least from that vantage point, the polling is not giving them a reason to take that next step in the rape of public broadcasting in this country.
And now they've stacked the staff with these ombudsmen who are, you know, William Schultz and Ken Bode, who are both conservative operatives on some level.
Yeah.
And their job is to, you know, oversee the integrity of the journalistic portion of PBS. It's a fixed game now, and I don't know what the hell to do to stop it.
Well, I mean, one thing is to get with the petitions that people are involved with, but this is the first baby step in a series of steps you're going to see take place, where you're going to find more and more conservatives and Republicans being urged to help fund PBS so that eventually they'll push these shows like Frontline and Moyers and the rest of these people off the air in favor of more right-wing stuff and then say, see, we're getting more money.
That's right. You know, Oscar the Grouch is going to be born again.
Yes.
It's going to be bad. 16 past the hour, we'll be back with the Brain Skid and Aiden Delgado in a little while, so stay tuned on Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Terry Jones from Monty Python. If you're like me, you're tired of having geeks and dogs repeat things you said 30 years ago back to you as if you don't remember saying them and then laughing as if they think they're so damn clever. I mean, wow, you memorized a 30-year-old movie? Oh, good show, old chap. Oh, great. Be president of the United States, come on. And now for something completely different. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Mantis Tiller Cultivator. Put the fun back in gardening. Call now 1-800-211-8001. That's 1-800-211-8001.
Twenty past the hour. What's going on? It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. You know, every morning we try to tackle the specifics of breaking stories out of Washington and around the world, and I really try to drill into what each specific story means. But sometimes, man, I'll tell you, it overwhelms me a little bit and frankly sends me into a bit of a brain skid. You know, as I get older, you guys, the mere mention of organ function or problems makes me uneasy. If someone mentions, like, kidney trouble or heart problems, pancreatic cancer, I get squirrely. I hate thinking that we are these machines with parts that break down. I guess it's some manifestation of my fear of death. And if that's the case, you'd think I'd be happy to hear in the past couple of years, scientists have really begun to push the envelope with genetic engineering. In Minnesota, they made pigs that are being born with human blood in their veins. In Nevada, they made sheep whose livers, hearts, and brains are largely human. In California, they injected human stem cells to make paralyzed mice walk. Yeah, I'm getting squirrely right now. Is it that, you know what I mean? I just can't talk about it. Is it that I don't want those animals to be used that way? Or is it just my fear of mortality again? I mean, there are two sides. I mean, just think for a moment about the quality of life that mouse now has because of the miracle of stem cell research. The mouse was paralyzed, and now he can hit the food buzzer again and get in and out of the maze without a ramp. Okay, so they paralyzed the mouse for the sake of the experiment, but his recovery is still miraculous. On the other hand, think about a human brain getting trapped inside a sheep's head. I mean, how horrible is that? To impose the plague of reason and self-awareness on an unsuspecting sheep, causing it to wonder whether or not it looks fat, or if its fleece is thick enough, or maybe causing it to have an existential meltdown, forcing it to peel away from the flock to find itself. But what about the benefits of animal research? Organs aplenty? Better meat, talking dogs. It's wrong, folks. All right, so it is the use of animals that really gets to me. Why can't we exploit the plant world a little more? They've had plant hybrids for years. Why can't they push the envelope in that direction instead of into the world of sentient beings? I like the idea of squirting a couple of drops of your own blood in a jar of solution and putting it on your windowsill. A couple weeks later, new liver. Pull the toothpicks out and install that bad boy. Or cutting off a nail and sticking in some dirt and growing a finger. How about a pancreas bush or a pork orchard? Brain tubers, testicle berries, limbs on trees. No, real limbs. You get what I'm saying? Saying, man, I'm just saying that. I don't know. Leave the animals alone. Farm humans and make better plants. That's all I'm saying. All right? That's all I'm saying. Am I wrong? All right. Maybe I am. It's probably a bigger issue, but that's what I got for that. Anyways, let's talk about this guy, Aiden Delgado, Riley. We read a piece by Bob Herbert. Mm-hmm. A couple of days ago. Aiden Delgado is a 23-year-old religion major from the New College in Florida. It's a small school in Sarasota. And, apparently, you know, on the morning of September 11th, he enlisted it as in the private, in the Army Reserve. And he was trained as a mechanic, and he was assigned to the 320th Military Police Company in St. Petersburg. And by spring of 2003, he was in Iraq, and he was stationed at the prison compound in Abu Ghraib. Now, apparently, his background was a little unusual because his father was a diplomat.
Yeah.
And he spent 8 years in Egypt. He speaks Arabic, and he knows a lot of stuff about various Middle Eastern cultures. And, you know, when he got there, apparently he was part of a battalion. He was part of a group of guys. This actually forced him to register, you know, as a conscientious objector, you know, while he was still there, is that he was with these guys, these American soldiers, and they would be on Humvees, and they would be driving by, you know, Iraqi civilians and just smack them in the head and break bottles over their head. He was with them as he watched these guys kick kids. Now, obviously, you know, we've had soldiers from both sides on this show. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there are plenty of American military soldiers there doing the right thing as much as they can within the environment they're in. Mm-hmm. But this is a guy that's got, you know, hands-on experience to the point where it disturbed him that he had to say to his CEO, look, I got to detach from this.
Yeah.
You know, I've got to, you know, pull out of this. I want to be put down as a conscientious objector.
Yeah, he did apply for conscientious objector status. And see, the thing about Aiden Delgado is that he saw not just the overt abuses. I think, and we can ask him about this, but I got a sense from reading this story by Bob Herbert that Aiden Delgado was nervous about where this came from among his American colleagues, the fact that he probably seemed to be the only one that had a problem with it.
Because he understood the culture. He had been there when he was a kid. He grew up, you know, talking their language, some, you know, at least Egyptian and some other Arabic cultures. And he understood the fundamental disrespect, but he also had to figure out, like you're saying, you know, what was was it that gave them this sense of entitlement? Because on some level, there's no way that you're going to win hearts and minds or even, you know, make them in the least bit comfortable. Because all it takes is two of these incidents.
Yeah.
You know, in a tribal culture, certainly, for it to be mythologized and taken for granted that the American soldiers are bad news, they're disrespectful, we have to be frightened of them, and they're here to do nothing but hurt.
And then, of course, you have the flip side of that, and that is that you know, the American troops look at every Iraqi kid walking down the street, and they see a potential suicide bomber, or they see someone. How else do you explain the fact that Aiden Delgado's sergeant, apparently, and he witnessed this, again, we can ask him about it, were beaten small kids with a Humvee antenna.
Yeah, but see, that's different. I mean, that is not being alert or aware or wondering whether or not you're going to get blown up by a suicide bomber who may be a young kid. That is going out of your way to create new terrorists, to make them hate us even deeper than they already do. Just to go up and beat kids with a Humvee antenna or to drive by a line of walking civilians and break bottles over their heads, there's no military rationale for that.
No, there isn't. But we're going to find out exactly what Aiden Delgado went through. He is going to be live with us on the telephone when we come back. And we've got some questions for him, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, it'd be nice to talk to him.
Absolutely. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
So join us here Sunday night on Air America Radio.
The revolution starts now.
Four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
We're having a show here. It's called Morning Sedition. That's on Air America Radio. That's probably what you're listening to, or some other outlet. Maybe you're streaming. Maybe you're satellite radioing it. Maybe you're just sitting there with a strange hat you've made and picking it up directly into your brain. Yeah.
Ooh.
And please, I can't say what I was just going to say. I'm going to get myself into trouble like they did on Randy's show. Hey, earlier this week, Lindy R. England, the Army reservist who personified the Abu Ghraib prison abuse scandal, pleaded guilty to 7 of 9 criminal counts. This past Monday, Bob Herbert's New York Times op-ed column featured an interview with Aiden Delgado, an Army reservist who witnessed abuses by the military in Abu Ghraib and other areas in Iraq. We are pleased to have Aiden Delgado join us on the phone from Sarasota. How are you, Aiden?
Hey, doing good, Mark.
Good morning.
Hey, look, you know, thanks for being with us. So why don't you give us a little background? I was trying to, you know, introduce you without knowing you from the article. It sounds like you've had sort of an interesting childhood and evolution into the armed forces. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, I guess what you could say, I had an interesting childhood. I actually grew up overseas the majority of my life. I only came to America in the year 2000 to go to college here in Florida.
And primarily you were where?
I was actually I was in Thailand, Senegal, and in the last 7 years of my high school, I was in Egypt. So it was actually kind of important because I learned to speak some Arabic and was sort of immersed in Arabic culture.
And what happened when why did you join the forces?
Actually, you know, I joined for pretty simple and pretty naive reasons. I wasn't doing very well in school. I was kind of bored with it, and I thought I would do something different and do a change of scene. So I actually signed up for the Army on the morning of September 11th. And just thinking I would get some skills and do something different, but it actually took me on a vastly different route.
I'm assuming that the events here in New York on that morning were what, you know, provoked you to make your decision in light of how you're feeling about your life anyways, right?
Well, actually, I mean, I had already, the enlistment process takes a long time, so by the fact that I had was signing my contract on the morning of September 11th means I'd actually signed it before.
That's interesting.
So it actually didn't play into my decision to join the military. What it did do was it justified my decision, and I felt vindicated initially by what happened on September 11th.
And what
when I saw how that was used and how it was redirected, I began to feel that perhaps I'd made a mistake.
Okay, and then what were you assigned to do in the military?
I was actually trained as a vehicle mechanic, a Humvee mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
I had the least glamorous, least sort of machismo job in the Army, and it was the last place in the world I was expected to, you know, see any sort of misconduct or be put in any kind of dangerous situation.
Sure.
But as they say in Iraq, you know, everybody is sort of on the front lines.
Okay. And where'd you end up there?
Actually, I did 1 year in Iraq, 365 days exactly. I served 6 months in Nusayr, or right around Nusayr, Talul Air Base in the south, and 6 months in Abu Ghraib prison, which at that time, you know, wasn't as quite as notorious as it is now. But it still had sort of a reputation from Saddam's era.
Aiden Delgado, did anyone in the Army, when you went in, try and steer you toward a position where you could make use of your fluency in Arabic? I mean, it seems kind of incongruous to have a shortage of people, you know, in the region who speak the language, and yet someone like you who does ends up working on Humvees.
Yeah, I guess that is kind of strange. To tell you the truth, when I joined the military, I didn't really tell them that I spoke Arabic.
Ah, that's why.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. When I did tell them that I spoke Arabic shortly before I was deployed to Iraq, they did make use of me as kind of an informal translator and interrogator, especially in Nasiriyah. I used to go to the city a lot to do things and get things done for the unit because I was literally one of two people in the battalion of over 1,000 men who could speak any Arabic, and I was not fluent by any stretch. But that's exactly how dire the shortage was.
So that's interesting. So you're in a position to understand what the locals were saying, you know, right in front of many Americans who couldn't understand at all. And also, I imagine your ability to speak Arabic, did that get you any flack from other soldiers on our side?
Well, to tell you the truth, I had been kind of earmarked as suspicious before I even left the States.
Why?
Pretty much because I could speak Arabic and I had lived in the Middle East. I mean, I was talking to a master sergeant about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, you know, just talking politics or whatever. And he turned to me with quite a bit of venom and said, if you love them so much, why don't you join Al-Qaeda?
That's unbelievable.
And although all of the guys, you know, respected that I could speak Arabic and they wanted to use me for missions, they always sort of looked at me askance, you know, that sort of anyone who could speak Arabic was suspicious. Many of them didn't know that there was a difference between speaking Arabic and being Muslim.
Yeah,
I even heard things like Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden is the head of the Islamic religion and sort of all sorts of very uninformed statements.
So that's suspicious. So you were suspected by some of these men who were marginally educated, and you know, and you saw a lot of behavior over there. Now, tell us about some of the stuff you saw in Abu Ghraib and some of the stuff you saw, you know, the activity of some of the stuff you saw happen on the Humvees and with the guys you were on the ground with.
Well, I guess I'd have to tell a story of Nasiriyah first, both because it comes chronologically first and because I see what happened at Abu Ghraib, both on the news and with my own unit, as sort of the outgrowth of this earlier brutality and this earlier violence. I see it as kind of the blossoming of it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talked about in the Herbert column and that what I've received an enormous amount of flack for, I mean, just personally, people have been calling me since the column, was that in the South, guys in my unit used to drive by in their Humvee and break bottles over Iraqis' heads. And
just,
I don't know why this is such a revelation. And it's
just regular Iraqis.
Yeah,
guys walking down the street. Right.
I mean, people have literally said things like, there are no Coke bottles in Iraq, or there's no glass bottles in Iraq. And this is just patently wrong. We used to buy enormous amounts of sodas from Iraqis in Nasiriyah, and they would come in bottles in flats of, you know, 100 or so. And I remember this very well because our first sergeant used to lecture us not to throw away the bottles because we need to return them for the deposit for the Iraqi who sold them to us.
Mm-hmm.
And they would keep these bottles and break them over Iraqis' heads. And this statement has been an unbelievable revelation for most people. I mean, I watch the chat boards and sort of the discussion forums, and to even say that has provoked an enormous, enormous outpouring of hatred and venom against me, against Bob Herbert.
For what?
The fact is,
for telling the truth?
But, I mean, people would flatly deny that what I saw happened. They would sit here in America and say that I'm a liar or that I made it up or Bob Herbert, you know, made it up, rather than believe that these sorts of things happen. But the fact is, I mean, a master sergeant whipped a group of Iraqi children with a steel Humvee antenna in Nasiriyah because they were crowding around him, bothering him for food and water. And, you know, I wish this wasn't true. I wish I didn't have to report this,
mm-hmm.
but it did happen. A Marine did kick a small child in the chest for asking him for a soda in Nasiriyah. I wish I didn't have to report it, but it happened.
Yeah, and this was in Bob Herbert's piece in the New York Times on Monday.
Yeah, and we went, when we went up to Abu Ghraib, obviously that sort of resentment of the Iraqis didn't vanish. And now they had Iraqi prisoners under their thumb. And so I don't think it's very surprising that the sort of abuses that we all saw on CNN occurred. And my own unit was involved in its own sort of incidents.
Describe that incident for us, Aiden Delgado.
Well, beyond just the sort of day-to-day interaction with prisoners, which, as you can imagine, would not be congenial, there was an incident on November 24th that was mentioned in the Taguba report, actually. So when people call me a liar, I always tell them to read the Taguba report. Prisoners had been demonstrating for several months in Abu Ghraib, mostly because they had been served rotting food that was infested with rats and had other problems. And it was freezing cold outside. So they were demonstrating, marching with banners in protest of their living conditions. The demonstration became very unruly. They started throwing stones and pieces of wood from the prison yard at the guards. The guards initially tried to quell it with non-lethal rounds. It wasn't effective. So they requested permission to use lethal force, and they got it. They opened fire on the prisoners, and they shot like 13 of them, I believe, and they killed three or four of them. And I know because one of the guys in my unit actually did the shooting and did the killing, and I talked to him after the incident, and he showed me photographs, which I have on my computer. And when I've been traveling around, I've been showing these very grisly photographs. And this was a major incident. I mean, our commander posted these photographs in our headquarters and was bragging that our company had killed more prisoners than any other, and the guys were talking about the prisoners they had shot, and I was just absolutely stunned.
Was this what...
They had shot unarmed men, basically, for throwing stones in protest of their living conditions.
Was this what sort of compelled you to register for conscientious objector status?
No, I had already actually applied for conscientious objector status about the third or fourth month that I was in Iraq. And I guess you could say what prompted me to become a conscientious objector. Well, I mean, it was a long process. It doesn't happen overnight.
Sure.
Definitely a sea change. But it was my encounter with, I guess, with Iraqi prisoners and sort of the face-to-face aspect of the war that really made my objection personal. I had been a Buddhist for some years. I had begun to feel ill at ease in the military for over a year before I even went to Iraq. But it was seeing my so-called enemy face-to-face, I guess, that really convinced me that I should take a moral stand. So by the time I arrived at Abu Ghraib, it was already well known that I was trying to become a conscientious objector, that I was opposed to the war. I wasn't carrying a weapon. And so they did everything they could to keep me as far away from the prisoner and as far away from the shenanigans as possible.
Now, you've talked about the shooting of a prisoner. You've talked about people breaking bottles over people's heads. You've talked about people whipping children with Humvee antennas. Where does the wellspring of hate that produces that kind of mindless violence, where does it come from where you sit?
You know, to tell you the truth, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not an expert. What I am is I'm an undergraduate of religion, and so I always view these things from sort of a religious and spiritual aspect. And what I really believe is that I think that after September 11th, in our nation generally, not just in the military, it became acceptable to make Arabs and Muslims the other, to categorize them as somehow enemies of the state, enemies of the American way of life, and in some way to look sideways at them. And I think that what's happening in Iraq now is a blossoming of that ugly sentiment, that ugly anti-Arab, anti-Muslim sentiment in the United States, which we cannot deny. You know, X number of mosques were attacked after September 11th, and so on, so on. And I also think it's been a very effective ploy of certain members of the media and the government to paint this as a religious or a theocratic war. You know, Muslims against Christians, East against West. And I think that has been absolutely key in turning these people into others and dehumanizing them to the point where Americans don't feel bad doing things to them.
Well, let me ask you a question. One more question here before we go, Aiden Delgado, and I appreciate you being here with us, is that wasn't there some element of it, too, that, you know, these are troops out there that don't feel like they have the full momentum of support from the American government, even from the American people, that these are kids not unlike yourself who went there because their lives were, you know, they were economically compromised, they didn't know what they were going to do, and now they were in a situation where they could do whatever the hell they wanted and just take out all that aggression on whoever's there, the other, as you call them.
You know, I think that's very keen insight because the brutality didn't surface until a couple of months in the war, at least in my experience with my unit. And I think that's because initially people were excited and happy and geared up.
Right.
But as that enthusiasm waned, and as the stress of being in the deployment and the horrible situation and the danger increased, then the instance of brutality increased.
That's interesting. All right. We got to go, Aiden. I really appreciate you being here. And be careful and take care of yourself.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Aiden.
Aiden Delgado, you know, he was featured in Bob Herbert's column last Monday, I believe, or a few days ago.
Monday, yeah.
Yeah, some powerful stuff. It's interesting to me, the belligerence that he's facing because of the statements he made, people insisting that he's lying because they want to deny the truth at all costs because they think that people like that who tell the truth. This is the same stuff that's going on at PBS right now.
Yeah.
The kind of thing that they want to stop is information like Aiden Delgado just gave us. It's 47 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
1-800-801-GAME. That's 1-800-801-GAME. Call now. 1-800-801-GAME.
Fifty-two past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
I gotta start saying things like 8 before the hour. You know, I gotta switch it up a little bit. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the 5-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milvington.
Dateline, Soldotna, Alaska, a town some locals say took its name from the old Athabascan Indian word meaning stream fork. While others say, who cares? We wipe them out, didn't we?
Oh, no.
Just like that bacteria scientists recently found festering in the previously believed uninhabitable volcano plasma vents in Mariana Trench, so too has a creeping virus of inestimable evil been found anchored in the most frigid outpost of human thought, Alaska. For somewhere far south of the realm of reason and city of Anchorage lies the frozen mud bog of Soldotna, home to an unthinkable money-sucking leech of religious dogma, the Alaska Christian College. 37 students strong.
Oh, no.
In the last few years, this mock college has received over $1 million in tax dollars for the sole purpose of teaching gullible co-eds the story of Jesus Christ and Br'er Rabbit, or whatever the hell the resurrection story is about. Money that could have been better used buying another Jaws of Life to pry exploded beer kegs from the chests of students at Chico State. But fear not, you bunch of listless, dunder-headed jackanapes who thought the Democrats had enough of their act together to win the last election because a group of agnostics and atheists, or agnatheists, just filed a lawsuit against the Department of Education, charging them with violating separation of church and state. Now calm down, Mark. I know you're all like, well, do you lighten up? They're just teaching Eskimos about Jesus or John. Well, let me pitch you this scenario, you apoplectic Muppet. Suppose it were the other way around. Suppose your tax dollars were used to teach your children that a sorcerer wishing to visit Sedna, the sea goddess, must first pass through the realm of death and then cross an abyss where a reel of ice spins near the eternally stewing cauldron of seal meat.
Hey, Mort, I don't have children.
I don't have any children, you know? Leave it up to you to completely miss the point, Mark.
Wait.
If it weren't for the separation of church and state, many of our good Christian children, including your mealy brood, might be force-fed other people's religions and taught about ice demons who dry up your intestines and fly to the moon on the sharp end of a knife instead of learning about it the way the rest of us did through the miracle of LSD.
Wait, all right, Mort. So what are the chances this lawsuit might stem the tide of the government-funded religious schools, my friend?
Wow, Mark, your head is melting. Words are coming out of your mouth, but not words, but words, you know?
Oh, my God, Mort, are you tripping?
There's no chance a group of atheists and agnostics can win this thing, Mark. We live in a theocracy. And as long as you've got to be surrounded by born-again Christians, you might as well make their heads melt in psychedelic colored goo.
Ooh.
And that's today's dispatch from
The war on brains.
You see the trails, man? Check it out. See the trails? You okay, man?
All right.
Why are you sweating? You okay? Do you remember your name, dude?
What are you doing?
I thought you were tripping. Aren't you tripping?
No, that was just a character thing.
Oh, all right.
Man, you were really way out of it.
Why do you take it out on me, man? It's not my fault. Whatever's going on with you, I didn't make you a vegetarian. I didn't do whatever. I don't know what hurts you. You understand? Why do you got to take it on me? You come in here on my show, you do your little thing, and then you take it out on me like I'm some sort of bozo. What did I do to you?
Well, you are some sort of bozo. Thanks for running it up for me.
Well, hey, you know, I love what you do. It's great. I want you to have a good day. Is there any possibility of that happening?
Absolutely not.
Okay. So where are you going now?
Well, I guess I'm going home, getting my bike, then ride to the office.
Yeah.
I thought you were in the office.
That's a good story.
No, the other office downtown.
Oh.
But first I'm going to rewind the archives and listen to the sex talk that happened earlier in the hour.
Wow. Oh. Well, do that. That's riveting. That's riveting stuff because this whatever we're doing right now is going nowhere. So why do I...
Hey.
Can we put an end to this?
Lord. Talk to your writers, fella. Mr. Benny, I'm sorry. Jesus. I'm here with a comedy genius and he can't even make one laugh out of 50 seconds. Hey, I just
got up.
I just got up 30 seconds ago.
Wow.
Christian, we leave the room and let them have at it.
Let's come back. We'll talk a little bit. It is the anniversary of Kent State. We have some other stuff we want to talk about when we come back. Michael Eric Dyson will be here to say that Bill Cosby is wrong, I believe.
That he will be. I saw him in the hall. We'll be back.
Six past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program.
That it is.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. And, of course, good morning to you lurking conservatives secretly wanting our kind of truth, which is the truth for the most part. You dig that? Because, you know, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can't be, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. But thank God we got this, you know, iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank this baby up and feed it some headlines. From the New York Times, Iran to resume nuclear plans, official states at UN conference. Iran to resume nuclear plans, official state view on conference translation. Bush vows to respond with all available forces, wishes four Marines Godspeed. Okay, from Fox News, staff hears of Bolton's good side. Staff hears of Bolton's good side. Translation, friends describe Bolton as more outgoing since killing spree. From the New York Times, Canada's leader is a skinflint, says a former admirer, Bono. Canada's leader is a skinflint, says a former admirer, Bono. Translation, rock star Bono perplexes fans with the use of the word skinflint. So now, Riley, you know I'm a relatively young man compared to you.
Oh, and, thanks, Lowe's. Gee, what a way to start an hour.
Actually, there's the same amount of distance between you and I think, as is between my wife and I, another generation behind us. But what I'm getting at is I have no conscious recollection of what went on at Kent State. And I'm assuming that you have some.
I was in college. I was at NYU when what happened at Kent State happened. And it has to be put in its proper context, which is that it was one of a series of events, mm-hmm. including a subsequent shooting at Jackson State that left two black people dead,
mm-hmm.
That really kind of changed the face of the anti-war movement in this country.
Today is the anniversary.
Of the Kent State massacre.
Killing. Yeah.
Four people were killed, and, you know, a lot of people looking back on it really don't think it had to happen on any level whatsoever. You had a group of young National Guards people who were very nervous about the motives and the motivations of these protesters, who, by the way, had not engaged in any huge amount of violence up until that point. But you'll notice how Aiden Delgado talked about, you know, how people reacted when they threw rocks at him. Somebody just pulled out a gun and shot somebody.
The guy, Aiden Delgado, we just talked to
him.
We just talked to him, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, of course, he was talking about in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Well, some of those same emotions, some of that same scenario was present on the Kent State campus in 1970.
You mean the sentiment against people speaking out against the war and people also against the war itself?
Yes, absolutely.
And what happened was, let me ask you this, Riley, after these shootings and both of these different protest situations, was there was the effect to quell the social revolution in this country a bit? I mean, how did people protest after that?
See, it had, I think, a dual sort of effect, Mark. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, it said to a lot of people that the government was much more serious than many thought about squelching this dissent. There had been the Summer of Rage in 68, and there were people that got their heads split open and you know, confrontations and demonstrations. And there was one that happened here in New York that I was in where it was a confrontation with a group of construction workers. But up until that point, other than civil rights activists like Martin Luther King and you know, people like Robert Kennedy, ordinary kids had not yet died. They were dying in Vietnam, but they weren't dying on the streets of America. Kent State changed all of that. Suddenly, people who thought, well, you know, yeah, we can protest, we can do it. Suddenly, they stared in the wake of Kent State. The naked power of government was in their face. And for a lot of people, it was a very, very traumatic experience and a very traumatic time, even if they were nowhere near the Kent State campus. And remember that during the spring of 1970, there were demonstrations at I won't say at every college campus, but there were huge numbers of demonstrations because there was the whole Cambodia-Laos situation where the American government had said there were no troops in Cambodia. There were no troops in Laos during the course of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And then people found out that, yes, there were troops in Cambodia. Yes, the president had authorized an incursion into Cambodia and Laos. And this provoked huge reactions on campuses all over the country. So a lot of people who were on other campuses saw in Kent State what could happen to them, and they were traumatized.
You know, I'm sure. I got to figure that these are, you know, sort of a lot of them are just, you know, regular college kids who never thought that that could happen.
Exactly. You and that's going to change the nature of the game at that point.
I'd imagine when I was in college, I'm sure there was a big difference, but I mean, kids are still kids, and, you know, what you're made out of really comes down to, you know, having that moment where you realize, well, I could get killed doing this. I wonder what kind of effect it had on a lot of people. It probably was, you know, fairly effective in squelching what they wanted to squelch in terms of a lot of kids' drive.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of protest. Now, we also had a passing that you wanted to talk about.
Oh, yes. Dr. Kenneth Clark, mm-hmm. A civil rights icon, in fact, a man whose work and research was cited in the historic Brown versus Board of Education decision, which, ironically enough, we're going to talk about shortly anyway, because it was at a commemoration for Brown versus Board that Bill Cosby made the statements that he made.
Well, let's listen to those statements, because our guest, Michael Eric Dyson, has written a book called Is Bill Cosby Right or Has the Black Middle Class Lost Its Mind? Now, this goes back in 2004.
Yes, it was
June
2004.
Bill Cosby speaking at an NAACP event to mark the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. It was May 2004. And this created sort of a firestorm, not only in the black community, but in all communities in terms of what the hell is Bill Cosby talking about.
Yeah.
Let's hear some of that, will we, Chris?
These are not political criminals. These are people going around stealing Coca-Cola. People getting shot in the back of the head over a piece of pound cake. And then we all run out and we're outraged. Oh, the cop shouldn't have shot him. What the hell was he doing with the pound cake in his hand?
Now, he was talking, obviously, about lower-income people, and this is another clip from that same event that's marking the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education in May of 2004.
I can't even talk the way these people talk. Why you ain't where you is, go wild west. I don't know who these people are, and I blamed the kid until I heard the mother talk.
And then I heard the father talk. This is all in the house. Everybody knows it's important to speak English, except these knuckleheads. You can't land a plane with why you ain't where. You can't be a doctor with that kind of crap coming out of your mouth.
This is an angry Bill Cosby. This was a Bill Cosby that a lot of people hadn't heard, though it was a Bill Cosby, I think, trying to get laughs, but it was also a Bill Cosby addressing race specifically in a way that he hadn't before publicly.
Well, Bill Cosby was, and we're going to get into this with Michael Eric Dyson, he was articulating a sentiment that has been passed at dinner tables in the black community, and not just among black middle-class people or black upper-class people, but among many of the same people that Bill Cosby was talking about. It's also interesting, I interviewed him some years ago,
Cosby.
And he used that same term, lower-income people. He's the only person I know, black or white, that describes, quote, the underclass in that term.
Well, you know, there's a lot to address. There are class issues, there's race issues, there is age issues, lot of stuff that Michael Eric Dyson talks about in his book. We're also going to hear a segment from the Chris Rock routine that I'm curious to hear if Michael Eric Dyson thinks covers the same terrain in a different language, clearly. It's 15 past the hour. We will be back with Michael Eric Dyson after this on Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Congressman Gerald Nadler from New York's 8th District, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio.
Experts now, 800-396-9711, 800-396-9711. That's 800-396-9711.
Twenty past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
You.
This is our America Radio's Morning Sedition. Right now in studio, the author of Is Bill Cosby Right or Has the Black Middle Class Lost Its Mind? Michael Eric Dyson. Good morning, sir.
Mark and Mark, it's good to be here.
Thank you, doctor.
We were just listening to Cosby before we went away to break. We listened to all the comments that you opened your book with and are in a discussion in the book. Now, I'm a comic. I come from a stand-up comedy background.
Yes, sir.
And I think that not only I think that Bill Cosby was being angry and serious, but it seems like he was playing for laughs a little bit in what he said because he got some laughs. But what I want to ask you before we start talking is this Chris Rock bit in the same arena of conversation that Cosby was addressing? I have the bit here. Do you have the bit? Can we hear it?
Who's more racist, black people or white people? Black people. You know why? Because we hate black people, too. Everything white people don't like about black people really don't like about black people. There's some going on with black people right now. It's like a civil war going on with black people. And there's two sides. It's black people and there's niggas. And niggas have got to go. Every time black people want to have a good time,
that's from Chris Rock's so Bring the Pain special 92. Mm-hmm. Is this is this his version of the same conversation or no?
Well, that's a complex question and it demands a complex response. I think on the one hand, absolutely, it is a parallel kind of expression. But I'll tell you what, it makes all the difference, the context you supply. If it's comedy, it's a heck of a difference than if it's a straightforward lecture where you're trying to speak to people about a substantive issue that you want to comment on. Chris Rock and a host of others, Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, Richard Pryor, have ingeniously spoken about critical social issues in a fashion of comedic observation, or Dick Gregory for that matter, where they were able to be sharp and insightful and self-critical and irreverent, which after all is what art is about. Now, what's interesting is that, yeah, Bill Cosby's doing that, but Bill Cosby has led the charge against most of that kind of comedy because he thinks it's reprehensible because it is stereotype mongering that refuses to deal with the positive edifying features of black culture.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the dilemma. On the one hand, we can say, yes, that's a parallel, but that's the very kind of thing that Bill Cosby has been against.
Right.
Not necessarily Chris Rock and the kind of genius of Richard Pryor and those comedians, but for the main, he has been certainly deeply opposed to most black new comics. On the other hand, I think that, no, we can't say it's the same because now Mr. Cosby is extemporizing, giving a dissertation, giving a, you know, free-floating kind of observational, comedic to a certain degree, but straightforward, serious thing. And therefore, when you're humorless as a comedian, that's a deep thing, because now you're trying to remonstrate against what you see are the pathologies of black people. Had he done it in a routine, it would have been differently received, because now it's not Bill Cosby, educator. It's not Bill, Dr. Bill Cosby speaking. Right. It's not Dr. Bill Cosby, philanthropist speaking. It's Bill Cosby, the comedian, making some jokes and trying to provoke people into it. But let me give you one final point here. The point that comes through with Chris Rock in that routine on Bring the Pain is that he's also skewering white folk.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to subject white supremacy to the same barbed insight, irreverent, transgressive discourse mm-hmm. that he does black folk. You will never catch Cosby cracking on white folk the way he cracked on black folk. That's the difference. There's no judicious balance
right.
or seeming appreciation for the flip side of that. And that, in that sense, I think that's problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Michael Eric Dyson,
yes, sir.
I have heard some interviews with Bill Cosby since he gave that speech at the NAACP. And one of the things he said, I mean, he hasn't backed up off of what he said, but right. one thing he did say was that he regretted generalizing about what he calls, and he is, maybe you can correct me, he's the only person I know that calls poor folks lower income people, but he said lower economic people, which is a kind of strange way of describing folks.
Kind of a sociological, abstract, clinical, dispassionate analysis.
He did graduate UMass, I guess. But, at a point, he said he regretted having generalized. Is that good enough for you?
Well, of course not, because the point is we ain't got that message. Of course, the offense is always on the first page. The retraction is always on page 38.
Yeah.
But he ain't been doing much retraction, bro. He's not taking the full advantage of saying, you know what, I really was generalized. No, he keeps saying low economic people. He went to Jesse Jackson's.
Yes, he did said, right after. He did.
The dirty laundry is getting out every day at 2:30. I'm not the one giving the dirty laundry, and it's cussing and calling each other the N-word. Nigger!
Well, okay, Doc. So my point is, he had a chance then to back up off of that first initial. Because we could have gave him some slack, like, oh, homeboy just went off that night. He just was pissed.
Right?
We know black people do that. You know, you get mad, and hey, we all could have felt like that one day. Yeah. I saw my cousin. Now I'm pissed. Hey, get a job. Get your butt up. I'm working hard. All right? We can dig that. The problem is the rant turned into a routine, turned into a tour. Now he had to blame the black people tour. He's going this coming Monday to Dallas, Texas. Dr. Cosby deeply invested in what began as a momentary lapse of propriety. And by the way, that ain't my problem with him. People say, oh, it should air dirty laundry. Brother, do your thing. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to do your thing, if you're going to air black dirty laundry, jeez, you just don't want to jump on poor people. Are you going to jump on the number of black privilege who have messed up their families? Are you going to put that on the table? You're going to put on the fact that raping young women is a sport among certain pockets, but it's dismissed? Are you going to talk about these black ministers in pulpits who are homophobic, who turn out to be closeted gay themselves? So you ain't going to put out. Now you ain't trying to put all that on the table, because that's upper bourgeois, that's black civil culture, that's black middle class. You just want to beat up on the low down, lower economic, these people, he said. Look at the clinical dispassion and the distancing of the language. Critical. Rush Limbaugh said that black leaders would have been on the front line, calling me up to write an op-ed in March with them, putting my teaspoon influence to bear, bring it to bear upon Rush Limbaugh for saying what he's saying. But Cosby gets a pass. And I'm telling you, the problem is, Cosby is not a right-winger. He's not Clarence Thomas, which is why he's more dangerous. We expect Clarence to say some stuff like that. When Cosby does it, white liberals who sit on the fence wondering about what remedies there are for black suffering go, if even Bill Cosby says your fault, I got to give it up.
We'll talk about those remedies and more with Michael Eric Dyson when we come back in just a couple of minutes here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
For you.
I have to
get help.
Randy Rhodes on Air America Radio.
I'm going to Republican rehab.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning. Tradition on Air America Radio. We're talking to Michael Eric Dyson. The book is Bill Cosby Right or Has the Black Middle Class Lost Its Mind? In the opening of this book and throughout the book, I want to make sure we talk about, you know, that this book is not just a response,
right,
but it's somewhat of a progress. It's a manifesto on some level.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
And it talks a lot about, it seems that when you address specifically Bill Cosby, you're talking about issues of age, issues of class, issues of race. And to me, it really, what sprung out at me was issues of how blacks approach their cultural identity in an intentional way.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And
right.
Barack Obama responded to Bill Cosby like this. This was on Meet the Press in July.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the basic premise that Bill Cosby was talking about, and I think he's right about it.
Now, you've got it. I just listened to you on the break. I mean, this is the great hope for the Democratic Party, and this is a guy. What about this idea of how black identity plays out in what you were talking about on the break as dominant culture in what we're talking about?
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing. First of all, I have enormous respect for Barack Obama. Went down to stump for him and gave him money. So I deeply and profoundly love and respect him. I disagree with him on this point when he says agreeing about the fundamental premise. What's the fundamental premise of Mr. Cosby? It was about an assault on black identity at the, quote, lower echelon, the lower economic people. And if we break it down, if we deconstruct and demythologize what he said, he was fast mad at the way black people name their kids.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Barack, you're a number one candidate for his dismissal.
Yeah.
Obama, you're a double Dutch dismisser in Bill Cosby's act. The way that Shaniqua and Taliqua and Muhammad and all that crap. So now, first of all, look what's going on there simultaneously. You're demonizing the invented names of black people that are pseudo-African, which says something about your denigration of black identity, Mr. Cosby, and you can't make a distinction between Shaliqua and Muhammad. Muhammad is an ancient Muslim name.
Absolutely.
So now you're throwing Muhammad in with Shaniqua. Don't get me wrong. I value both of them.
Yeah.
But my point is, you don't even make that distinction, which is problematic there. Then on top of that, Mr. Obama, Senator Obama, my very dear friend, Bill Cosby is going to mess up your name because you got one of them. Now, you ain't Bill and George. You're Barack Obama. So my point is that Mr. Obama has the right to talk about the complexity of Mr. Cosby. I didn't hear it there, and I wouldn't want to reduce his response to this soundbite. But what I would suggest to Senator Obama is that his fundamental premise is so flawed because it is nothing more than a centuries-old tradition of the black elite assaulting the black poor. Right after slavery, when the black elite and the black aristocrats were in their cities, they had to keep a tight rein on the poor black people because the white folk were putting pressure on them. Plus, wanted to prove to white people if we could rehabilitate the bad behavior of our own errant Negroes who were poor, then that will be an argument to you to treat us right. It didn't happen. Even Du Bois, in the early throes of his career, believed that reason and enlightenment would prove to white people our inherent at least equality with them, and as a result of that, would treat us better. When those race riots kept coming and those lynchings kept coming, he found out that the enlightenment was demythologized. So my point is that there was a whole bunch of nastiness in what Mr. Cosby said. It was against how people name their kids, how they wear baggy pants, what they do about Africa, how they talk. And Mr. Cosby said he can't talk like these people. Oh, I disagree. You talk just like him. You are one of the Obonis laureates of black America. This man and that corner and the puttin' pop and the weed. You are an Obonis of extraordinary skill. And Fat Albert, by the way, was not the king's English to the Queen say. Even the look was visual ebonics. And when you look at how with the umba gomba bee ba back ba later, now that is the assertion of a syllabic B that's hard into your construction. Uh-oh. That ain't nothing but ebonics.
Michael Eric Dyson, there's something that troubles me about, and we talked a bit earlier about Bill Cosby generalizing when it comes to people.
Right.
And, you know, there's a situation that just took place here in New York where a woman by the name of Monique Dixon, who lost her son to a drunk driver, went up to Albany virtually every day Mm-hmm. Until she got lawmakers to pass tougher drunk driving laws. Now, Monique Dixon is not a rich woman.
Right.
She was not a woman who, you know, had a great deal of means. She didn't hire a lawyer to go do this. She was a woman who lost her only child. And by the way, there's another child, another child named Reyes, who was very seriously injured. Mm-hmm. Now, through her work and the work of this other young man's mother, they went up there and on their own managed to get these lawmakers to do that. And there's something about the way Bill Cosby frames his argument that makes it sound like the Monique Dixons of the world or the women, for example, the mothers of the guys who were convicted in the Central Park jogger case and others who have been doggedly determined to seek empowerment for black people on a certain level, if only for their own families, that they don't exist.
And are you referring to Mr. Cosby in relationship to the loss of his...
Well, there is that, too, the loss of his own son. But my point is that there is something about the way he frames poor people that denies that these kinds of people, people who are active, people who are determined, people who are willing to do the work, because there's an implicit laziness that Cosby kind of imbues to young black people.
You're absolutely right. I think that's a very powerful point we need to repeat. That is that these people that he talked about, these people, not our people, not us people, these people, are so extraordinarily beautiful, powerful for the most part. Yes, we have some mess ups, but Paris Hilton got a sex tape out and her ratings are through the roof. If you want to look for licentiousness and, you know, the being victim of consumer culture, don't start with Shanae. Look at Paris. But anyway, yes, you're absolutely right that these people, poor people, black people, are the ones who mostly marched in the movement when Martin Luther King Jr. and others were in Alabama and in Montgomery, and they were trying to start the bus boycott, and E.D. Nixon, the black Pullman porter worker, working for the working class, black people came to the ministers and said, you've been taking these poor washerwoman's money in your churches every Sunday, and you Negroes can't even stand up for black people, because the movement, for the most part, was fueled by the participation of everyday black people. And these are the people, by the way, and the movement that Mr. Cosby refused to join. Let's not miss that point either.
Important.
He's beating up on young people for not... You're not taking advantage of the education, and the people got hit in the head with the rocks. And Dorothy, wait a minute now. You're the one who said in the 1960s, I will not go to a place where rocks are being thrown at me and I can't throw some back. You refused to be physically involved in the civil rights movement. And even when we said, okay, do what you do best, use your comedy, he says, I refuse to use my comedy as a platform for civil rights. I am about overcoming racial difference. I will not speak about racial difference. He says, I can best overcome the situation by speaking about the similarities of black and white people and not the differences. Well, if you only do that, you can never speak about what is different about black people: economic inequality, lower birth rates, the way in which our young people die at a rate that approximates a third country. So, yes, these people are being scandalously stereotyped. Their everyday forms of resistance are being dismissed, and their political insurgency that has been far more profound than Mr. Cosby's is being wiped away by one fell swoop of a powerful figure with the bully pulpit that stretches across the media. That's why what he did was so profoundly dispiriting and, I think, quite frankly, damaging to the interests of black people.
And it widens this schism that you were talking about that's been in the black culture for years.
Oh, my God.
Since the beginning.
Oh,
now,
yes.
How does this play out on the political stage, Michael Eric Dyson, now that some blacks are being appropriated into the Republican Party?
Right.
They're being exploited, I think, by the Republican Party. And it's
willingly, though.
Right. So, but some of them, I think on an empowered level, if Bill Cosby is going to present what he's saying as empowerment, it sort of honors a certain conservative ideal. And given that the Republicans are trying to use, moral wedge issues to put a schism into the black community, how is this going to play out on the political stage?
Well, this is how it plays out in Detroit, Michigan. And I was on Hannington Cones the other night, and they played an excerpt from this one. Cosby goes, we know there's systemic racism, please. But he rushes past that. He says the victim pimps and the poverty pimps are going to have you down. That's straight out the playbook of the right wing. Victim pimps and poverty pimps. That's straight out of the right wing castigation of liberal attempts to try to help poor black people. And so I think it plays beautifully because the right wing has been quite generous to Bill Cosby. Yesterday,
Rush Limbaugh beat up on me because I appeared on the Today Show talking about Mr. Cosby. He had a whole long thing where he's defending Mr. Cosby. Now, then on top of that, public policymakers who are conservative are taking a cue from Mr. Cosby. So I think the right wing and the conservatives have been highly celebratory of Mr. Cosby, unlike they were in response to the other Dr. Cosby, Dr. Camille Cosby, who wrote an op-ed in 1997 in response to the death of her son, saying America taught this Russian immigrant from the Ukraine how to hate my son because they taught him how to hate black people. And she was roundly reviled and seriously castigated by the same people who now embrace Mr. Cosby. Why? Because she spoke truth to power as a powerful black woman, as a rich black woman, identified with struggles of ordinary black people. She knew that all of the money she had could not prevent her son from being murdered in a culture where black people are still demonized by the dominant set. So it's playing out beautifully among the right wing and conservatives and giving them succor by a figure like Bill Cosby. Mm.
Michael Eric Dyson, you know that in many instances when people talk about what Bill Cosby said inside the black community,
right,
inside our homes, one of the things that always comes up is, well, he's entitled because he's done so much for black education.
Yeah.
He's donated millions upon millions of dollars. What was it, $20 million to Spelman, millions of dollars here, millions of dollars there.
Yeah.
So he has earned the right to say what he says. What do you say to that?
Well, look, if you don't give a dime, you've earned the right as a living, breathing human being to speak up, number one. So I don't think money confers that privilege. I think the ability to be a thinking, cognitive human being earns you that right. Now, Bill Cosby has been incredibly generous beyond the pale of imagination in terms of his philanthropy to Spelman College and others. And some people say, well, but, you know, he ain't giving that money to poor folk. That could be a distinction in the sense that he's not giving it to aftercare programs in schools. He's not giving it to people who are not already college ready. So we need to give it to people before. Well, Bill Cosby can't do everything. So if he's giving $20 million to the college, then you get together and give money to the other people. Bill Cosby can't be a one-man anti-poverty program, although he has been. Now, interestingly, though, if we say he's a leader because he's given all that money, therefore he's on the right. Well, if that's the case, Bill Gates is the greatest black leader we've ever had by that logic, because Bill Gates gave Negroes, black people, Africans in America, at least $100 million, maybe $200 million, and Africans throughout the world. So just upon the and by the way, Bill Gates, interestingly enough, in the New York Times a month ago, it was reported, said that he got it. I need to give money, matching funds to inner-city schools where crumbling infrastructures are preventing us from being able to compete technologically in the world. So now Bill Gates, far superior in wealth to Bill Cosby, is able to see the necessity for reaching out with compassion to poor people. We ain't trying to romanticize them, but can you get your foot off their neck, Cosby? Can you remember how you were poor? Can you remember that you dropped out of the school after flunking the 10th grade not once, not twice, but three times? You then went to get a GED when you went to the Navy, and then leaving the Navy to go to Temple University, you enrolled there, dropped out after 2 years. They gave you your degree based upon life experience. You then enrolled in an EDD program at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and they gave you course credit for doing Sesame Street and Electric Company. You, and I'm not dissing him. I'm saying the guy's a genius if he never went to school one day. But don't forget your difficult educational trajectory, and the pedigree of your education rests upon people being kind enough to acknowledge your genius. All we're asking is recognize the poor Bill Cosbys who are coming up now who ain't got no name yet. Don't be hating on what they call their kids, because Oprah ain't no regular name. Condoleezza ain't no regular name. Shaquille O'Neal ain't no regular name, but you ain't gonna beat up on Shaquille because he might look at you. Superman might look down at you and go, Bill, you're crazy. Leave me alone. Leave me alone, Bill. I will beat you down.
Michael, can you hang out for a couple minutes?
Oh, yeah,
no doubt. We'll take a couple calls over the break. It's 47 past the hour. We're talking to Michael Eric Dyson. Come back, Air America Radio.
Join the Morning Sedition right now. Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
That's cabinet refacing from Sears Home Services. 1-800-828-1200. That's 1-800-828-1200.
52 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
See, Michael Eric Dyson's bopping his head to this music, too. I'm not the only one.
We're here with Michael Eric Dyson. Morning's
got
edition.
Got a lyric on the Kaiser tip.
On Air America
down
Radio.
On thing, never get the lip. I'm sorry.
Michael Eric Dyson is rapping.
What's up? What's up?
We got some phone calls. But I don't want to end this.
Go.
All right, Michael, so, we got Bill Cosby's first cousin on the phone.
Oh, very good.
Ron in Pennsylvania. How are you, Ron?
Hey,
what's
Ron
on your mind?
Yeah, how you doing, Mark?
All right, this is the same Ron Gordon I know.
Yes, sir.
All right, how you doing, man?
Mr. Gordon, how you doing, sir?
You know, I'm in my car and I'm coming home from work, and I'm listening to Dr. Dyson.
Yes, sir.
You know, beat up on Bill Cosby.
Oh.
You know, I'm trying to figure out what's your real beef. You know, because Dr. Cosby didn't say anything. You know, I belong here in, I'm about 20 minutes from Philadelphia, and I belong to Big Brothers of Bucks County, and we have an outreach program that we work in northern Philly.
Mm-hmm.
And you know there are whole sections in Philadelphia where black people, normal black people just going out trying to meet the man to pay the bills, can't walk out at night. You know, 5 o'clock comes, they got to lock their doors, not go out at night. And I have to go to those communities to take their children to baseball games, to basketball games. Mm. I really want to know, Michael, what's your real beef with Bill? What's the real beef?
All right, thanks for your call.
Forget the fact that he may not have couched his words in the kind of language, or he may not have given the kind of illumination properly that you wanted to hear.
Yes,
what is your real beef with Bill?
All right, thanks, Ron.
Thanks, Ron.
Yeah, Ron, and I hope, Ron, if he can leave his number so I can contact him, you know, in Philadelphia myself, since I'd love to speak to him.
Can you give me my number?
Okay, yeah, I don't really want you to say it on
air.
Don't
say it on air, please.
But leave that. But Brother Ron, first of all, thank you so much for your approach, and I'm sorry you feel that I'm beating up on Bill Cosby. Do you think Bill Cosby beat up on poor black people that night? Now, what's interesting is that if you say I'm here beating up on Bill Cosby, and I've admitted that he is a genius, I've talked about his extraordinary philanthropy, and that night I don't hear one positive thing that Mr. Cosby said about poor people. I would just be interested from you to really find out if you think that Bill Cosby beat up on, would you characterize it in that exact phrase, that he beat up on poor people when he talked about their names, he talked about them not being able to speak English, he spoke about their educational pedigree, he talked about their consumer habits, and he lambasted them across the board and said not one thing that was redemptive about poor people. I really want to know, do you actually think he beat up on poor people that night?
Listen, sometimes we need our consciousness pricked, okay? Bill is a passionate, he's passionate about education.
Okay.
Now, he may not have couched the words or said the terms that you hold
dear, yes, sir.
And
yes, sir.
Passionate
yes, sir.
About, but he said what he felt in his heart at that particular point in time.
Okay.
Now, a lot of people agreed and a lot of people disagreed.
Yes, sir.
Now, for you to have to go write a book about it, I'm struggling with that.
Wait, hold on now. Well, give me the same respect. I'm passionate about what I believe.
I'm giving you the respect. I'm on the phone.
Oh, no, you are. No, I'm saying, absolutely. I'm saying to you, are you going to give me the same respect to say, hey, Dr. Dyson or Michael Eric Dyson is just passionate about what he believes. He said in the book what he wrote. He is not beating up on Bill Cosby because Bill Cosby didn't beat up on the poor. It was about passion.
Dr. Dyson, when you say that my cousin is as dangerous as Clarence Thomas, I take strong.
No, I didn't say that.
Strong,
I didn't I say that. I said, no. I said
right,
Clarence
Ron.
Thomas. Well, let me tell you what I said. Clarence Thomas, I said, we know if Clarence Thomas said it, we expect that from him. The problem with Bill Cosby saying it is that he legitimates, because he's a much more successful and much more acceptable figure, some of the right-wing conservative viewpoints that people want to see put forth. That's it. That is dispiriting and that is dangerous.
Okay, we're running out of time, so let's try.
But I'll talk to you off the air. I'm going to talk to Brother Ron off the air. I'm going to talk to him off the air.
I think the big question, too, is as we close here, is that I think what you're saying is there was no proactive message other than some, you know, sort of vague, tough love coming out of Bill Cosby, which doesn't work. It doesn't apply. It's not going to promote social change. It's going to widen the gap.
It's going to widen the gap. And what Brother Ron is saying is very important. If we could talk about, and what he does is beautiful, working with the, Big Brothers Club. The point is, can you make a redemptive possibility for black people to respond to their condition without putting your foot further on their neck? And I think Cosby did that.
Well, thank you, Michael Eric Dyson. We'll be back tomorrow with another big show.
Paul Haggis and Lou Dobbs.
Is Bill Cosby right? Is the book.
All right. Have a good one.